of coming to the other state. So we had a document here running into 450 pages and another running into 300 pages, and you put all that stuff together, it's close to 850 pages.
Yeah.
Rico, by the way, Alan unfortunately regrettably is sick. So can you just ask the letter to get real? This is a waste of money, actually. If you had sent this to me a week before, I would not have read it. No parliament in the world could bet. No MP in established democracy expected to read 800 pages in half an hour or even a week. All wanted was a summary of what you're going to say. People can be emailed it and it's their job to read it. Everybody could be given an iPad. This is really destructive, you know. An iPad, an iPhone, a computer. If they want to read 800 pages, that's their right. Let them read it. But for us, we just need a summary of the issues. Actually, our interest in it is not simply for its own terms. We passed a bill last year and we need to check where things are. It's also because it might be of some relevance to the financial sector regulation bill. Initially, the aim, you remember, colleagues, was to discuss the African Bank when we look at the FSR bill in August. But then what happened was the Reserve Bank governor wasn't available for today. And we felt that we were keen here to actually respond to issues that the committee feels it must raise soon from our budget and check and report. So, we just can note that that has fallen away in the draft program since you, with the amendments made yesterday. The second thing, Enrico, if you'll remind me, we have to vote on the report of the study tour that we undertook. And I would like to meet the participants in the study tour for 5 minutes after this meeting, if possible. But for now, these are the two issues. Let's start then with an overview by the Reserve Bank and National Treasury on the report into the African Bank. You will each introduce yourself, and we will write to Cindy to say this is what he has said. Once again, we will repeat to her that we would like all documentation for the meeting on a Tuesday by the Thursday, and for the Wednesday by the Friday. This started in 1998 when I first started. Sorry? Yeah, I know, you just have to remember, this, at least I started raising it in 1998. So we've got an excellent parliamentary liaison officer and a very good team with her. I don't blame Cindy. Really the people who are meant to appear for us who failed to deliver on time. I'm not saying anything about the current people before us. Okay. That said, I hope Alan will be in action by this Friday, although we will be here at least in committee sittings and so on. Right, let's over. Look, you're fine, right? You were absent yesterday. Yes, Mark. Well, welcome back. Over to the team.
Thank you, Chair.
Shall I suggest a maximum an hour between the three of you? Maximum.
I think your presentation will probably be less than that.
Good.
Gives us more time for questions.
Yes, that's what I think people want.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much to the members of the committee for listening to us today. My name is Kobe Mario. I'm the Deputy Governor of the South African Reserve Bank, and I oversee the Bank Supervision Department. I'm joined by Mr. Denzel Bostander, who on the 1st of June will become a Deputy Registrar of Banks. Mr. Bostander was also responsible for the process leading up to the directorship of Africa Bank, supervision of African Bank, and has managed the process of putting the curatorship in place and liaising with the curator. I'm also joined by Mr. Hukile Davidson, who is from the National Treasury, works in the Financial Sector Policy Unit. So with your permission, I'm going to do a brief summary of the issues, and we'll take it from there. I guess there are two or three broad parts of the presentation. The first is I will attempt to give an explanation of the events leading up to the curatorship of African Bank. The second is I would like to give a brief summary of the issues covered in the MIBA report, which is a very long report, although the executive summary I think is good reading. It's about 50 or 50 odd pages. And thirdly, I'll ask my colleague Denzel to give you a brief background into how the curatorship has proceeded so far, what's happening there. Chair, on the 10th of August 2014, the Minister of Finance, Minister Mthanda Nene, after consulting with the Registrar of Banks, took African Bank under curatorship. The sequence of events leading up to that was that from as early as 2011, the Reserve Bank picked up certain issues within African Bank, and I'll go into a bit more detail in a few minutes, on why with tests that they would be put under what we call intensive supervision. The main reason why we thought that they would be put under, they should be put under intensive supervision, relate to the fact that they were what we call monoline lender, a monoline bank. In other words, they had a single product that was unsecured loans, and the vast majority of the income was derived from that single source, interest on unsecured loans, and or insurance related to unsecured loans, and or the sale of furniture and provision of credit to people who bought the furniture, largely on an unsecured basis. We thought that this was risky, and we put bank under intensive supervision. Chair, the second set of issues that led up to the curatorship of Afghan Bank relates to Elohim's, a furniture group that was acquired by African Bank in 2007, and it was quite clear as early as 2008 that Elohim's was not necessarily a good purchase, and the price paid was incredibly high, and that there were losses incurred in Elohim's that were being subsidized by African Bank. In fact, in detail of the Madag report, he calls the loan made from African Bank Investments Limited to Elohim's, a loan of 1.4 billion rand. He calls that loan reckless because it was unsecured and had little chance of being repaid. The next set of issues in the Madag report relates to issues around governance. And there are two or three broad sets of issues there. The first set of issues was whether the board had adequate fiduciary oversight and independence in relation to African Bank. It is not uncommon for the board of a holding company and the board of the bank to be the same when there aren't significant other businesses involved in the group. However, in this case, African Bank Investments Limited owned African Bank, which had a banking license, Elohim's, and Stanjen, which was a captive insurer. Considering the loan that was given from African Bank Investments Limited to Elohim's, or from African Bank to Elohim's, it is quite clear that there was a potential conflict of interest in the raise of the boards between African Bank Investments Investments Limited and African Bank. And it, in the view of the Marvel report, that conflict of interest should have given rise to questions about the loan and to questions about the transaction. And so the independence of the board is a big issue that comes into focus. The next set of issues that come into focus is around the accounting standards that were applied by African Bank. According to the testimony and the submissions of the chief financial officer at the time, Mr. Nitya Nalia, in his view, the accounting practices of African Bank were very aggressive. The view of the Deloitte, who were the auditors at the time, as spelled out in the Migrant report, said that, yes, they might have been aggressive, but they were within the realms of acceptable. What was quite clear was that the provisioning practices in African Bank was not the most prudent in banking sector and was not in line with banking practices or best practices in general. To be specific, if somebody does not pay for a month, they get put into a particular bucket. If somebody doesn't pay for 2 months, they get put into a particular bucket, or 3 months, 4 months, etc. African Bank only began making provisions when the person had not paid for 4 months, or what we call the CD4 in the fourth bucket, whereas most banks start to make provisions much earlier. And it was a very aggressive impairment policy that was a contributing factor to the deterioration of the finances. The next set of issues is around, I guess, the growth of unsecured loan book. And this was not just an African Bank issue, but was a broader issue. Unsecured loans were growing at about 30% a year between 2010 and 2012. And African Bank had seen very aggressive growth in unsecured lending. It was at the view of the Reserve Bank that there were broader systemic problems with unsecured lending, and we took steps to slow the growth of unsecured lending down. Those steps included talking to the banks, moral suasion with the boards, and putting additional capital charges on banks that were specifically focused on the unsecured lending area. What we call Pillar 2B or Pillar 2 capital charges, they're largely non-disclosed, but we put additional capital charges on the banks if we feel that the business is particularly risky. I think positively we've been able to slow the growth of unsecured lending down from growth of around 30% a year to growth of less than 10% today. But African banks certainly increased the size of its book very aggressively in the period 2010 to 2012. By 2013, it had become quite apparent that the size of the non-performing loan book was growing and that additional provisions were to be made. African Bank had a rights issue of about 5.5 billion rand at the end of 2013. They were able to raise additional capital. And it was our opinion in the process, in the lead up to the period before the curatorship, that they needed additional capital. There was a difference of opinion between the CEO and other board members about how much of capital was needed. In the end, the bank put out an announcement that they needed 8.5 billion rand of additional capital. According to the submissions to the MIBOR position, the CEO felt that there was a much higher amount that was needed, around 5 billion rand. The bank did put out a statement asking or saying that they will need additional capital. It was at that point that there was a significant liquidity squeeze in the bank where they had to raise funds on the short term, in short term windows, and people just wouldn't lend them the funds to continue business. And on the 10th of August, we put the bank under curatorship. The next set of lessons here is about, and the Marburg report makes this quite clear, that in any good corporate governance model, the board has to hold the chief executive accountable. And you cannot have a situation where the chief executive's personality dominates the board and the company. And it was quite clear from the testimonies to the Marburg Commission that in African Bank, you had a founder of the bank, the CEO of the bank, who, in the words of Marburg, had a sense of hubris, and that was one of the factors that contributed towards poor decision-making over the period, and those factors eventually led to the collapse of African Bank. African Bank did not have lots of retail deposits. In fact, at the point of curatorship, out of a loan book of about 50 or 60 billion rand and short-term debt of around 40-odd billion, they only had 111 million rand of retail deposits. When we put the bank under curatorship, our first priority was to protect those retail deposits. The second principle was that for the first time in South Africa, and actually one of the first time in the world, one of the first experiences in the world where we fought what we call a bail-in of equity holders and debt holders into the rescue of African Bank. And there was what we call a waterfall structure where equity holders would have lost almost all of their investments. It's too early to tell, but they probably would lose in excess of 95-96% of their investment. Senior debt holders would lose 10% of their investment, and subordinated debt holders, at the beginning we thought they would lose almost all, but at the end we structured a deal where they would lose about 60-62% of their investments. So we forced a bail-in. We forced subordinated debt holders, of which there were about 4 billion rand, to take a 62% haircut, 67% haircut, and we forced senior debt holders to take a 10% haircut to contribute towards the resolution of African Bank. The note that we provides some details on the way in which we structured the resolution. It's been a long process. We had to go to Parliament to get an amendment to the Bank Act to give the curator the power to allocate assets to split between what we call good book and bad book. We had to give the curator the power to structure the waterfall in terms of losses in a particular way. The Banks Act did not have those powers at the beginning. The Banks Act now does empower the curator to make those sorts of decisions. See, from a financial sector regulation bill perspective, I think there's some very important lessons that can be drawn and have already been taken into account in the drafting of the Financial Sector Regulation Bill. The first of those lessons is that the Financial Sector Regulation Bill allows for what we call conglomerate supervision. Let me put it this way. Let's assume that you've got a bank that has an insurance company and a furniture arm, and I'm speaking purely hypothetically, There could be significant losses in one arm that may affect the bank in the medium to long term. Under the present Hanks Act, we can only supervise the bank, which has a banking license. We don't have the ability to supervise the other legs of that. Under conglomerate supervision, we could deem it proper to draw the particular structure around the conglomerate to include significant entities such as an insurer or in this case, a furniture retailer, if we think that there's significant risk to the bank. And I think that that's a very positive development in the financial sector regulation. But the second element is that prudential supervision of insurers will move into the prudential authority. At the moment, prudential supervision is done by the Financial Stability, Financial Services Board, FSB. And we think the merging of prudential supervision between banks and insurers will deal with both conglomerates that have bank and insurers, but also broader systemic risk in the economy. The third issue that we think is very well dealt with in the financial sector regulation is what is the powers of the Reserve Bank in the case of a financial stability or a potential financial stability issue. We think the financial sector regulation provides adequate powers to the Financial Stability Oversight Committee and to the Governor of the Reserve Bank to act and act speedily if there is a financial stability event or event that threatens financial stability. So it's often asked, why did we rescue African Bank? The international recognized definition of systemic has three components. One is size, two is interconnectedness, and three is complexity. African Bank was not big. It was about 1.7% of the banking assets in South Africa. So on the side box, we could put an X there because it probably doesn't think that has been systemic. On complexity, it wasn't a very complex institution. It had a single product in the main, unsecured loans. But we found that when we looked into the detail, there was significant interconnectedness between African Bank and the rest of the banking sector and the rest of the financial sector, mainly because African Bank raised debt in the wholesale market, and a lot of that debt was bought by money market funds, which were either controlled by banks or pension funds or asset managers. And there were significant investments, in this case a total of 44 billion rands worth of investments, that the pension funds, other banks, and asset managers had in African Bank. And we were concerned that if we had what we would call a run on money market funds, so you couldn't have a run on the bank because there weren't significant depositors, but if you had a run on money market funds, it would pose a systemic risk, not just to African Bank, but to the broader financial sector. And it's on that basis, using a financial stability argument, we took the decision to ask the Minister of Finance to put the bank under curatorship. So I'm going to stop there. I'm going to ask Denzel to talk a little bit about how the curatorship has gone so far, the structure that we put in place to separate good book from bad book, the new equity structure of Good Bank or New Hopeful, which is Good Bank, and to talk a little bit about the launch of Good Bank, which took place on the 6th of April.
When we drafted the African Bank Resolution Plan days before 10th of August, when the announcement of the curatorship was made, we started to split bank into good assets and bad assets. But we particularly decided to transfer the good assets into a new entity because of the possible litigation issues that may arise within the existing African Bank Investment Limited structure. African Bank Investment Limited is currently under business rescue, and there was a new bank controlling company created called African Bank Holdings, and the new African Bank, which retained the old African Bank name, is essentially a new registered company. That new entity, the bank, transferred good assets from the 60 billion rand book, about 20 billion to the new African Bank, and that was good assets. So that's only the good loans, but about 24 billion of the total balance sheet of Good Bank consists of cash, which is also comprised of a cash injection from the shop of about over 3 billion rand. Now, just to brief the committee on that, of about 3 billion rand that have been injected into the new entity, we've already last week, received back a payment from the creator of about 1.6 billion rand. So there's only about, because the total loan that was advanced was about 3.28 billion, so there's about 1.6 billion outstanding on that now, and we believe that we'll, in time, fully cover the loan. Then we went through a rigorous process where we had to make sure that the new entity had to, obviously, because it's a new registered company, had to apply for a banking license, and we went through the normal procedure in terms of going through a process where we assess whether this entity would actually comply with the Bank Act and can be registered as a bank. We finally made the decision to register our banks in consultation with the Minister of Finance. The new entity, the New African Bank, and New African Bank controlling company should be granted a banking license, and that decision was taken in March 2016. The New African Bank, the operations was launched on the 4th of August 2016. That was the Monday just after the first of April. That was on the 4th of April, so that was Monday just after the 1st of April. We already had our first meeting with the Chief Executive Officer of the New Africa Bank, Brian Riley. He's an ex banker. He's from a previous West Bank Chief Executive Officer. Just to make sure that in the new entity that we don't find the issues that we found in the old African Bank. They have constituted a new board of directors. The chair of the board is an old banker from Asher or Bafis Africa, Louis von Zierner, who brings his real experience into the new bank. Now, one of the banking license conditions was for the New African Bank to diversify their products and their sources of income and their revenue streams in order not to be so vulnerable to one specific unsecured lending credit line. We've, in the banking license application and in conditions, given the CEO about 2 years in order to achieve this. So to have, for example, mortgage lending, vehicle asset finance, and transactional banking in order to make sure there's some additional sources of revenue. In terms of the insurance side, now, within the South African Bank, African Bank Investment Limited was not a successful entity because of the old African Bank. It was a successful entity and made a profit prior to the problem years because of the insurance lack that was included standard. There was an attempt by the consortium of banks to buy the stake in or to buy standard from the African Bank Investment Limited shareholders. That deal unfortunately found through, and in order to make sure that the resolution of the bank was still successful, we had to go with another plan, with Plan B, which basically comprised of the bank and African Bank Holdings, the bank controlling company, establishing a separate insurance company that can basically complement the income of the bank within the rest of the group. The SARP, as mentioned previously, took up about 50% of the shares in the new entity, with the consortium advanced with the remaining 25% and the PIC with another 25% as the shareholders of the of the New African Bank Holdings Limited, or the new bank controlling company. And I think so that's just on the process in terms of curatorship and the establishment of the bank thus far. Thank you.
Can I add one? We've been asked fairly frequently about how long we intend holding this stake, this 50%. It did not be intended for the Reserve Bank to own banks. It is not the intent of the Reserve Bank to own 50% of African Bank for a long period. However, we do not want to put a time frame to this. When we think the bank is sustainable and on its feet, we will dispose of our investment in there. When you put a time frame, you immediately put a discount on price. And for that reason, we're not putting a time frame. However, it is not our intent to hold the stake for a long period. In fact, both ourselves and the 25% held by the consortium of banks is likely to be put up for sale in the future when the bank is sustainable and viable.
My friend, no. Are we done?
All right. Those of you who came in late, I just drew your attention. Even now, it's difficult to draw your attention. So we'll wait. So those of you who came in late, the committee decided that you will summarize for us these few documents, which we received at our table this morning. So I hope you're ready to do that. No, needless to say, I know that. But nevertheless, one of you will summarize in a moment. Try questions, comments. Why are you smiling, Zimbabwe? Aren't you Parliamentary Budget Office, Antonia? Aren't you research? You've been asked to summarize this. Very shortly. But Mr. Media and Sophisa, Makosi, Sandy? We've got plenty of time today. Plenty. No, today you can have 70. It's fine. I'd rather go early, but who knows what you have in mind for me. I can't leave you. You can slip away when you want. By the way, colleagues, comrades, we have to vote today on a report. So we have to have a quorum, come what may. Enrico says, good. He's on the ball. Right, Mr. May, who's in the
Thank you, Chair. I've got two lines of questioning. Let me begin with the first, which is to begin with my view that at least in one respect the South African Reserve Bank is complicit in the collapse of African Bank. And the argument is as follows. If you look at the executive summary concerning one of the directors, Mr. Sakutu, the Myburgh Commission reports, and I'll summarize this briefly and kindly, was that Mr. Sakutu, in paragraph 19, was the chief risk officer of the bank between 2004 and 2014. That Mr. Sakutu was not qualified to be the chief risk officer of the bank. And finally, that Mr. Sakutu did not have the capability, for various reasons, to make any contribution to resolving the crisis faced at the bank. That is an executive summary. But what is shocking is if you turn to page 60 of the report, one finds in paragraph 4 on page 60 that his appointment was endorsed by the South African Reserve Bank. Now the question here is, first, what process was followed to endorse Mr. Sakutu? Who exactly, and I want the names, who exactly interviewed Mr. Sakutu for this for his appointment? When was he interviewed? Who finally approved the endorsement? And what gave the South African Reserve Bank such confidence in Mr. Sakutu? And then finally, given this failure, what action has the South African Reserve Bank taken in order to ensure that something like this doesn't happen? And then, finally, do you concede that in at least in this respect, the South African Reserve Bank is complicit in the collapse of African Bank? That's the first question. The second question has to do with furnishing a report to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. Now, it's my view that the South African Reserve Bank, again, erred in not making a copy of the final report available to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. If one looks at Section 69A of the Banks Act, 69A12, the Act is very clear. A report by a commissioner contemplated in accordance with the provisions of this section shall be forwarded to the registrar, the minister, and in the event of a finding contemplated in 11C and 11D, to the Attorney General. And 11C and 11D, as you know, refer to whether the business of the bank was carried out recklessly or negligently, and Section D, whether the business of the bank, whether any person can be identified by the commissioner who was partly responsible for that. Now, if we look at the executive summary, we find that the commissioner finds that, in fact, in paragraph 98, the business of the bank was conducted negligently. In paragraph 99, the business of the bank was conducted recklessly. In paragraph 100, the business of the bank was again conducted negligently. And as to whether any person was party to the conduct, the commission finds that yes, the directors of the investment bank and the bank were responsible. And despite that, the report, it appears to me, is never referred to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. There was an obligation for that report to be sent immediately and directly to the National Director of Public Prosecution. And to the best of my knowledge, at least by the 22nd of April 2016, a year after the report was furnished to the Reserve Bank, it had still not been reported and referred to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. And we hear now, only after the publication of the report on the 26th, in May, that the report has been furnished to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. So my question here specifically is, first, did the commissioner refer the report to the National Director of Public Prosecutions? If he did not, did he make a recommendation to the Reserve Bank to send, to furnish the National Director of Public Prosecutions with a copy of that report? And then, more broadly, why was a copy of the report not referred to the National Director of Public Prosecutions, and when, finally, was it referred to the National Director of Public Prosecutions, and can, does the Reserve Bank concede that it failed in not furnishing the National Director of Public Prosecutions with a copy of the report? My last line of questioning, Chair, is the process followed to make the report public. Now again, if you look at Section 69A of the Banks Act, Section 30, it reads as follows. An examination or any report by a commissioner under this section shall be private and confidential unless the registrar, after consultation with the minister, either generally or in respect of any report of such examination or such reports directs otherwise. Now the section is very clear. The registrar has an obligation to consult. And in this case, the obligation is to consult with the minister. Instead, it appears to me that what the Reserve Bank chose to do in contravention of this act was to consult with the witnesses in the interests of fairness. Now, those witnesses had already been offered an opportunity between the 12th of January, I think, and the 5th, between the 19th of January and the 30th of January to make submission to the Minor Commission before he produced a final report. What the Reserve Bank appears to choose to do is to replicate that procedure and consult witnesses, amongst other things, on whether they thought that the public, whether they thought the final report should be made public or not. Again, in my view, the Reserve Bank erred because the act is clear. The registrar did have an obligation to consult with the minister, not with the witnesses. So again, does the Reserve Bank concede that it erred in not making the report public sooner? Thank you.
Thank the norm here, we take all questions. Well, a reasonable number of questions. I'll take, well, maybe the first three people, and then we can...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks to the reference for the information. A few questions from my side. One of the things that you have indicated that there shouldn't be problematic with ABA was the question of their interest in NRH. Right? So if you have to educate me, before a bank started investing in how to consider to plant banking institutions, then they require in form of approval from you. And if they do, what would you have considered? Because I hear you, you're saying there are a lot of problems which emanated from that part of the investment of the deal. That's one. You, number two, you talked about the red lights you started, you started seeing, I think, much earlier. And then refer to the government using more association to try and mitigate certain things. But obviously, if more association don't work, that is a step that the bank should take and see the bank take a step. I am also assuming that over the years, apart from the risk officer that has been referred to, my question would be, what has been the role of internal auditing in this whole process? The issues within the internal audit, what was that position? That's the one. But it doesn't end there, the question of external auditors. You see a few areas that you have the dividends at the time of an agent, medium rents. Would the bank not consider for the same liquidity of the bank at the time of dividends have been paid? So then we can say, one, there's Minister of the Resource Officer, because he's part of the village team of one, and he's ready to look at these things. But for me, the question of the internal auditors and the external auditors, how do they say? Because as you know, that one of the problems that emanated from the global economic crisis in the U.S. was that the financial institutions that received the treaty effect, and then a few months down the line, it was disaster. So one of the check and balance that we always rely on is the question of internal auditors that are the external auditors. If anyone come up, there's a problem from a responsibility. And then yes, the whole board of, not just the whole board of the SMB, right? They have to decide the responsibilities around this thing, and what is their position, what are they seeing? You speak about different programs of debt holders. If you don't mind, I'd like to know who the smart debt holder was at the time when the bank went to the app. There's one thing which troubles me, that three things that you had before you could see that you are going to save the bank or not. One of them is size. You talk about interconnectedness, and very specifically referred to the other banks, and that was the great risk which is become apparent, and then the complexity. But you look at the interconnectedness. My hypothesis is one would be the two banks that we have are even more interconnected than ABA. I would like to tell you that again, if they are, there's a subtext here in your email report that says, if you see that interconnectedness in the bank, then you feel obliged to save the bank. If I an investor in the bank now, immediately a problem of moral hazard comes out of time consistency. Because banks make sure that these different banks which are there, they're interconnected, and then they've got these other two elements of size and complexity. It is that the bank is saying that you come to arrest you. I am allowed to make that assumption. So if I am right, I think moral hazard just crop up, and then people will further engage in this record lending and related activities. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it was number three.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I think we need to appreciate the progress that has been made so far. And I think it's important as well to acknowledge that such a challenge was unprecedented in South Africa. And though we would have hoped that SARS would have intervened much earlier, but when they did intervene, there was actually, the resilience was successfully carried out. So I don't think we should be that negative. I think we should take this as a learning curve. And that is my take of the whole situation. Well, I wanted to know though, you know, sometimes it's very easy for us to jump into conclusions without us sufficiently applying our minds on the causes of the problem. Now, I just want you to reflect, you know, as to what extent are the structural deficiencies in our economy are attributable to the manner in which after your bank went into the kind of space. Now, the reason why I'm saying that is because there is something, there is a narration that is not often told, which is the fact that this Abbey was actually operating in the space of your marginalized, your financially excluded, those who are not able to secure loans in a normal bank, and most of them will actually go to Abbey. And I think that narration is actually very important, because going forward, we need to know how are we going to, you know, mitigate against the risk that has to do with the structural economic challenges that we have in South Africa. I think that is going to be the first question that is coming from my mind. The second one is the conglomerate of supervision. I just wanted to get some sense from you. Do you think our current legislation is sufficient in giving especially to perform the supervision over aspects that are not necessarily financial? Now, I also wanted to comment in terms of the plan going forward in terms of the Twin Peaks legislation, because if we are going to be, if we have an opportunity to tighten the legislative aspect of things, especially with this process that's underway currently, and I want to know to what extent are you aligned to that as you move forward, because the reality is that that's where we are moving to in the future, and probably the issues of market and potential are not going to be a kind of challenges that we initially faced, and probably they will be mitigated against. The third question I have is the one around, there's been some concerns around capital. And I just want to be comfortable that SARS is actually drawing from that experience. Obviously, I know that capital is also a deposit-taking institution, and therefore it's not necessarily going to face the similar same challenges as AFI, which was more of a Mother Christmas is very impatient. I just want to know whether we are actually, sufficiently monitoring what is happening in that area. I am saying that because when the economy contracts, which is what we are experiencing right now, it is institutions like Capitec that are often vulnerable going forward, because you will actually, people have to now decide, do I pay my loan or do I buy my bread or put my email on the table or whatever. And these issues are intertwined as far as I'm concerned, and I think it's going to be important that we get a sense that you are on top of your game in going forward so that we don't face similar challenges in the future. The other thing that you said was, you know, you kept on saying, I mean, I sometimes get worried to people's concepts that appear intelligent and very catchy, but I'm not sure if I do understand him. The third on referring to aggressive accounting practice that it has been had, and you also refer to aggressive impairment policies. Now, at what stage does it become aggressive? Is it at a stage where it is not necessarily going according to norms and standards, or is it aggressive because you are getting into the market space that is risky? And I'm very careful about risky because we are always putting the fund of risky people. And South Africa, unfortunately, capital is a color, and that's a fact. And this is why I think it's important for us to get your division at what stage does it become aggressive, so that we know that we don't assume that that's what you mean. Probably you mean something else. We don't want to be reading between the lines. We want to read in what you are in what you are saying correctly. And the other thing that I also wanted to know is that in terms of your of the plan of STAR going forward, at what stage would STAR intervene? What are the key, given the experience that we've had, and I tend to be futuristic because obviously what has happened has happened, and we dealt with that problem, we are dealing with that problem, but the most important thing is how do we get into the future. Now, at what stage are we going to be, is AFPI going to actually intervene, or what are the indicators that AFPI is using to say, you know, once this ABCDE is happening, it's time for us to get in, to intervene. You know, I think it's important for us as politicians, remember we're not bankers, we are just here to perform oversight, but we also want to see this kind of prosper, and we want to make sure that our financial institutions remain healthy and strong. And that is actually important for us as public officials, and if you could actually assist us in that. And I also wanted to know what is happening with the non-performing loans. Those non-performing loans, obviously, I would imagine that they were left in the old bank. Now, when they were left in the old bank, what is happening with them? Are they just sitting there? Are they not going to be recovered at some stage? What's going to happen? Or are we writing them off? What's happening with those non-performing loans? Can we get an indication on that? And the other thing you've mentioned is the fact that going forward, which is something that I also do support, is that you don't stop cannot see it in that space, laying in the space, and obviously at some stage you will set your stake. When you are saying that we have a lot of marginalized people who are not necessarily financially excluded, who are not necessarily, you know, part of your mainstream economy, are those the considerations that you have? And if you have, what sort of mechanisms do we have to ensure that they don't also go into the space that is going to end up putting the opening up too much effort, opening our financial sector to respect it? Although it might sound good to say no, the you know you will be selling and the other senior debt holder, I mean your new partner, the senior debt holders are going to relinquish their stake. I'm just worried because you have mentioned it to us that government was also a major issue in the thing. And me, I don't think, you know, as much as I agree when it comes to staff, but the other shareholders, I honestly don't think that we should be rushing into that. At least we should be making sure that the systems are in place and those people, they actually bring in their own expertise of overseeing, you know, that the governance issues are in place, everything is intact before everybody pulls out. Because it's very easy for staff to pull out and all the major banks to pull out, and the next thing you have is that you are back to square one, to the same problem that we are running away from. So I just wanted you to know if we have applied our mind in terms of managing the transition and making sure that we don't actually leave a gap in between that will make us vulnerable. And finally, Chair, I wanted to say I don't subscribe to the school of thought that says we should be approaching in blame. I don't subscribe to that school of thought, and the reason why I don't subscribe to that school of thought is because South African financial sector on your own is a very healthy sector. Yes, there were mistakes. You shouldn't have allowed us to get into the state furniture and what have you. That's not their purview. That's not their space. But going forward, we need you to find a way of how we need to take against these things. Because in future, we have to be much stronger and we have to be, our fiscal oversight must be more richer than it is now. Because we already have a precedent. Previously, we didn't have a precedent of this magnitude. And I really think we should be congratulating them in the manner they have they've navigated through this. The curator has done extremely well, in my view. And I think we should say well done where it is true. Thank you.
I see others going out of study, and then Pinky. Now, some of the questions have been very precise. I tend to say, let's take this lot of questions first. But I'm cool. If people want to, are there going to be long questions? Because it's clattering. Okay, Pinky, go while Tani is collecting herself. Okay.
No, sir. Mine is just one or two comments because I fully agree with the approach that Comrade McCarthy has taken, and also appreciating the work done by the FAB so far. I think what becomes critical as we're going forward, and I think it's one of the things that we will want the Deputy Governor to also assure us that the Twin Peaks will sort of assist us in preempting some of these things and tightening the screws in one way or the other. But two, it's about the sub also being very, putting their foot down, especially on fitness and propriety tests, something around that you do on your the board of directors of the banks and so on, because you are the people who also do all those tests on every individual. So it must be very thorough so that whoever is put to be part of the executive or whatever board that you do, that fitness and propriety test is done adequately, and you know that the bank is in good hands. The other issue, it is a requirement for a bank to have auditors. And the auditors also certify the business plan of the bank. Now, those kind of things, let's not just push and let it not be malicious compliance, but you guys must also make sure that surely the auditors have done their work and this business plan is going to work accordingly. Of course, I'm not sure, Chair, because, you know, the Twin Peaks is not going to separate the work of the SAP and the work of the Financial Services Board. There's something that I picked up from the Deputy Governor to say, on the lessons learned, conglomerate supervision, whether going forward, because you were saying the bill also speaks to that. Do we still need to, is the bank still having, is it still going to have those kind of things given what the Twin Peaks is going to do? Do you still see conglomerate supervision being relevant, or the Twin Peaks will then assist in unbundling some of these things so that everyone is hands on in terms of dealing with that thing, and you don't have an egg on his face. Thank you, Chair.
I'm certainly going to take a different approach. I'm not going to ask you a question. So every time I meet him, I remember him for being in Africa Lost National Trainer, and now, and then graduating into, no,
listen to what I'm going to say. When I say now being the deputy governor, then I say we have arrived. Because we when I was in the UCC, we used to believe that we need to inject young blood, because young blood brings new ideas and experience for one of. So I'm going to take an ideological outlook in the discussion, because that's what we seem to do, and it's our duty as public representatives to put the police perspective every time, and not just ask questions, you see. We are bound to be where we are with the African bank. And I'm going to illustrate why we are bound to be where we are. You see, if you prohibit a nation from getting educated and getting skills to be able to participate in the job market, you are subjecting them to a situation where they will find manual ways of existence. I repeat, if you subject a nation and the majority of it to illiteracy, ill health, poverty, it has no other choice but to learn manual skills. I don't know, let me make a simple example. When people don't afford houses, they go to banks, they borrow money, and they know they can't afford, and the bank thinks that they can go to the township to recover. Without you withstand offers, you will never get that house. Anybody who buys that house from the bank that is repossessed will never stay in it. That's simple as ABC. You can read the statutes, all of them bring them. The statutes will not be like that. That's the response of the masses when they are faced with difficulties. So you can replenish the books and write better statutes on how the African bank should have behaved. I think they did what they were supposed to do, helping the poor. That's what they're supposed to do, and it was bound to come to where it was. So whether you believe that the investment in LLMs was not right or wrong, somebody had to take that risk, that calculated risk. But unfortunately, the managers are limited. They are the township and understand the day-to-day challenges that our people experience. So they did not have an idea when a person says, I'll try to pay this. That's what means. All the best they could do, actually they should have given them 6 months. Let's look how many people lose their job on a daily basis and go to the pool of unemployment and cannot afford to pay their bills. Because they are replaced by mechanization in the factories, robotics, and all those equipment that are used in the job market that replaces unskilled labor. As we speak in the current conjunction, we are still faced with the fact that when mines close down, government should take responsibility of paying a reskilling of those people, thousands of them. Okay? And it's not a system that we invented as a democratic state. It's not the ANC-led government that has came with those problems. The ANC-led government never built houses where there was no sanitation, there was no tar roads, there was no electrification. It did not do that. It's correcting it. And we are bound to be where we are. And we need some little bit of understanding by those who understand what themselves and think it's as easy as ABC to understand the life of a black person in our communities. So, we also appreciated the intervention of the South African Reserve Bank to look at the books and rectify. It's a pity that Chef gave that language. He gave the S-word, the poor, remember that, like he said before he died. And when I looked at him, I understood that racism and capitalism doesn't know any color, you see. When you are taught in a particular thinking, doesn't matter whether you are black and white, you don't understand the life of the poor. That's why he had to reverse those starting mistakes and he had to insult the poor. And you know, I believe in the spirit, so the spirit took him away, so the spirit wanted to save him, don't let them clean him up. When he come back, good person, he will never again insult the poor. So, when you know what, it's really, that's not the rope, that's what we're talking about. And of course, put it in a very fast way. When capitalism thinks it can survive, it survives at the cost of the poor. Unfortunately, that's why we say, and I'm challenging anybody who's questioning the policies of the African National Congress, they still want to build a developmental state here. Where we say we need to have a mixed economy. We need to have an economy that will understand where we're coming from. It should aspire to change lives to the better. That's why half of the budget of the of our government is spent on education. That's why we have the jobs fund. That's why we have the internship programs. That's why we've got NASA. Because we understand that if the nation is educated, its skills base will go up. It will be able to participate in the economy, will be able to inject labor in the private sector, in the public sector and so on. People will create jobs for themselves. They will come with a big dish to any institution. Any institution. And you see, Marcos, if a person takes the loan, fortunately, because when we have credit checks to say that if a loan is 5 years and older, you can't recover that money from that thing. You see? So maybe we should bring that piece of legislation here so that people can see and understand. Because it's not just malicious individuals who said, I will not pay for 5 years. And I know after 5 years, this will be removed from the books. It's people who literally cannot afford to pay. But also, there are organizations that take risk portfolios, deliberately so, taking advantage and say, okay, I give you whether they qualify or not, it will be their baby to pay back. And if they don't, we'll impose interest on that credit, which is not going to be possible. So sending people, families and so on, is not going to help to resolve the challenge that we have. So it's a policy matter. It's a matter that, going forward, we have made suggestions when we went to see the South African Reserve Bank, that there needs to be management engagements on a quarterly basis to ensure that, that's what I suggested last time we were up, that there's any warning signs you can see, and fortunately you are able to sit in these committees that are convened by the governors to look at the performances of these banks. Because to see that with integrity, people just undermine the statutes. There is a guarantee that they follow the law to that. When people do perfect maximization, they take higher risk with an intention to get a short-term turnover. It has happened in many institutions. We have learned that. And communities just put it in a very interesting way that the European health bill for many institutions, but there was an economic crisis. And this was caused by lower banks, actually. Not your average, not your the standards of your A bill in this context. They keep those, it was not calculated risk, it was a higher risk, because it had anything to do with their own earnings as individuals. Wanted to earn more by shifting the profits higher and taking the bigger risk and overlooking all the necessary stop-gap measures that are in place. So sure, basically that's my humble submission in this context, that it was bound to be there. There's no elitist questions that go to answer this question, the situation that the country was faced with. Whether you were able to deal with it at that time, it could have happened, it could have happened with any other bank, for that matter. That has taken responsibility for the... It could have been with the first bank. That has taken responsibility to look at the poor. It will never affect your family banks. They never take that calculative risk. They've never done it to the poor. The poor never get anything from those family banks. And it's the responsibility of government to intervene. And you did a good job. The government has been to the stone decision by that type of intervention and rejecting funds. So we always appreciate that kind of interventions going forward. But we're in a better position. The country is doing better, we are moving forward. And in the next 15 years, we will not experience the same. There will be MPs at the time, we will not be discussing what we are discussing today. Thank you very much.
I think, to a large extent, I agree with what Nkosi is saying. I think the majority seems to be saying, well, that's a bit my view, that look, I don't have any doubt, although I'm not sort of sufficiently clued up to be precise and specific. I don't have any doubt that the Reserve Bank earned. That maybe you could have intervened earlier, as Nkosi says. Maybe you could have scrutinized the board of the bank better. But I think overall, my view, and I think the view of the majority, is it very well, actually. This is a bank, after all, that deals with the poor and disadvantaged. And it's more vulnerable than... you know, the established banks are. And as you yourself said, as Lisa pointed out,
initially, you know, used the three-standard criteria and didn't feel actually raise an interconnectedness of the financial system as a whole. So, hey, this could have happened in the U.S. This could have happened in Germany. Anyway, if you look at what happened in 2008, it's astonishing. You know, the most established financial system in the world, or at least the way, if you like, the global financial system is most powerful in the U.S. it happens. I think if you look at your performance as a whole, you've done very well, actually. And Tony's point, I mean, there are not many to be, I'm going to be age square. I mean, I owe you from a distance, right? You're a little lighty, frankly, in the 80s, right? And quite frankly, when I look at you, you look like the typical Reserve Bank governor I see on the CNN News and Sky Television and so on. They're much older than you are. You know, it's like the Chinese youth league. You have to be 70 to be in the Chinese youth league, you know? So really, what I'm saying is, I agree with Tanvir. I think you're a very competent team. Your governor, our governor, where did he come from? He's running around in the treehouse, in the hotel house thing, right? Look where he is now. I think it's inspiring for my generation. Okay? It's very inspiring, I'm the oldest here, for my generation, declaring my generation. Okay, declaring my generation. Okay, Pinky declaring. We all look so young compared to me, right? So anyway, that's true. You won't be able to ask any questions for the next 6 months for her to be like that. But on a more serious note, I think you all have done well. Really commendable. And I think that, but I do agree that if there are people responsible over there, whatever their skin color, they can't get away with this, right? Who suffers ultimately? So I think if there are people with the process of the court system, I am struck also by what Tommy said. The same thing struck me as many of us speaking. Actually, you know what, Tommy, you can't speak about Sukhothi says. You can't speak about the deceased in a negative way. But, I mean, it was very, very unfortunate. You need to apologize, sir. And I know him from a distance also. So I don't think that's typically him either. So, you know, but, you know, the main thing for some of us here is, what are the lessons? I don't think it won't happen again, unlike others who are so optimistic. You don't have to be a Marxist to actually understand. It's quite possible in these volatile times. Mm-hmm. The point is, you are best prepared now. What the committee will do every year then will not forgive you if you repeat the same errors. I think that's the point my coach is making, right? And, you know, let me tell you a little anecdote. Because I happen to be embroiled yet again forever and never fulfilling a report for voting today. When we went to England, I don't know how many people were with me at the time, but we met somebody who took us around the Reserve Bank. And she said, quite sincerely, she said, what are you coming here for? Your Reserve Bank is so short, right? We learn lessons from you. I think she was being polite, as the English often are, without necessarily being sincere. I'm not saying as the English necessarily are. She is a type, a groupie. But there was something about her, instinctively you felt, that was very sincere about it. Then I'm sitting next to somebody, and he said, hey, how's the Reserve Bank governor? Right? As if he's very warm. In other words, the British, I mean, the Union of Reserve Bank, what do I know about these things? My sense is London's the center of the global financial system. But then again, the guy speaks to me. Maybe, I can't recall, members of the delegation, those who can be open-minded enough, might admit that in some other form it came out in the formal exchanges I had with them. But certainly, in the two informal exchanges I had, both of them, one bloody, telling me, hey, what are you coming here for? What's such a wonderful Reserve Bank, the highest regard you said to me for your Reserve Bank and so on. And the other, in a most sort of fleeting, slightly veiled way, said the same thing to me. So, hey, you know what, you made some mistakes, it's better you admit that, which I think you're prepared to do, and let's learn the lessons from here, let's see what we need to put in the financial sector regulation bill. You may not want to answer this question for diplomacy reasons. What else do you think we can do beyond the three things you mentioned? I'm not going to repeat them, boring everybody was here. We should insert into the SSR bill to reduce the prospects of what happened to the African bank happening again. And by the way, not that I can make much of this, but since they've been picking up that Capitec Bank is a bit shaky, I mean, what sense? It's a fleeting piece I saw in the paper in the last 10 days. I forgot what I read. If you can remember, or anybody else can, that might prompt something. So Capital Bank, you've been praising. Not you, the financial commentators have been praising, right? And Capital Bank, at one stage, the business day was commending the word, for their performance. And they're also a bank that deals with the less advantaged and poorer income, trades now, stuff in our society. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for those kind words. Let me start off by dealing with a few of the policy questions. In some banking systems, there is a policy framework where a bank should not fail. We don't feel that we have a policy framework where a bank should not fail. If a bank is badly run, if they make significant mistakes and errors, a bank should fail. Our job as regulators is to ensure that the system is sound and safe and secure, that depositors are sound and safe and secure. But we can never guarantee that bank won't fail. We will do as much as we can to minimize the possibilities of a bank failing, but we can never guarantee that there will not be a bank that fails. I don't think any supervisor will stand up and say, there won't be a bank that fails on my watch. I take over a registrar of banks on the 1st of June in a week's time. I am not prepared to say that on my watch there won't be a bank failure. I would absolutely do everything in my power to prevent banks from failing. But sometimes, if a bank is mischievous, if their bank is reckless, if a bank misleads the market, if the bank abuses investor funds or depositor funds, then they might fail. Our job is to ensure that the system is sound and secure. That leads me to the second distinction. Where is the dividing line between supervising a bank and running a bank? Right? We are the supervisor of the banks. We can have very firm and frank discussions with the bank. We can give an instruction to the bank. Sometimes the bank does not comply. For example, we tell them they must find a buyer for LREs, that they must sell LREs. Either they couldn't or they wouldn't. I don't know. Right? As part of the intensive supervision process, fairly early on in the process, we saw that this was... And so, as it's a public policy matter, and the public must debate this issue, but where do they feel the bounds of the supervisor ends and the job of the manager starts? Because it's not our job to run all the banks. We do not have the capability or the capacity to run all the banks. Our job is to supervise them. And we will attempt to supervise them to the best of our abilities, but there will be, and I'm almost certain that there will be circumstances when banks don't listen to us, don't do the right thing, make inappropriate bets and investments, and they get into trouble. We will, to the best of our ability, attempt to resolve the issue in a sensible manner. In the next calendar year, you will be presented with both the resolution bill and the deposit guarantee scheme. Both will be elements of the Twin Peaks framework to make our banking system more safe, more secure, and our proposal in the deposit guarantee scheme is to protect depositors below a certain level. I think the discourse is around 100,000 rand, and any deposit in a bank with deposits of less than 100,000 will be protected. And so our job is to attempt to resolve disputes or problems in the financial sector with as little impact as possible on poor. But we cannot guarantee that there will be a no failure system. And we are not in the we are not in a no failure system. That leads me to deal with the next question about was the Reserve Bank complicit in the collapse of African Bank? Again, I draw the distinction between the ability to supervise a bank and the ability to run a bank. You have to, at some point in time, draw the line and say, this is the responsibility of the supervisor and this is the responsibility of the board and the management. I'm not saying that we did not make mistakes as the Reserve Bank. I think there were mistakes made. I think there were lessons learned. But as I think is pointed out in the Marbury report, you cannot hold the Reserve Bank responsible for the failure of African Bank. the responsibility for the failure of African Bank cannot lie with the supervisors. There isn't any evidence or any sense that it was a supervisor's fault or mistakes that were made by the supervisors that directly led to the failure of African Bank. African Bank was a failure of governance, a failure of risk management, a failure of imprudent accounting practices, a failure of hubris, and in some cases a failure of investors underestimating the risk in the bank. And so whether the Reserve Bank was complicit in the collapse of African Bank, I will not concede that the Reserve Bank was complicit. I will concede that we made mistakes. I will concede that we have learned lessons, and that there are certainly things that we are doing differently today because of those lessons. But I will not be prepared to concede that the Reserve Bank was complicit in the collapse of African Bank. The mistake that was, or the issue about whether Mr. Tami Sokodu was a fit and proper person and whether he had the requisite qualifications to be a chief risk officer, I certainly think in hindsight the South erred. I'm quite prepared to concede that in hindsight. However, at the time that Mr. Sokodu became an executive of the bank, Mr. Sokodu was a director general in government, a very senior civil servant, a very able and capable person, and we felt, the people at the time felt, that he was a fit and proper person. In hindsight, and I guess sometimes you can be a fit and proper person and then as time goes by you lose some of your capabilities for certain reasons, as is described in the report. It's hard to ascribe the responsibility to the South. But yes, we must tighten our fit and proper person's tests, and we have done that. The second question on furnishing the report to the NDPP. Let me deal with the issue of why it took us so long to release the Mivan report. Our interpretation of the Banks Act is that the implication of the Banks Act is that in general the Mivan report will be a confidential report. Let me rephrase that. In general, such commissions and investigations will be confidential. It is our view that it is in the public interest to release the Mivan report. There were two or three considerations that we wanted to have. The first consideration was around whether we thought the release of the Marburg report could impact on financial stability. And so we had to take our time to figure out whether the release of the report would impact on the system, the financial system. We don't think it will have an impact on the financial system. The second thing that we needed to do was to ensure that the release of the Marburg report does not compromise the establishment of Good Bank. And it is true that part of the reason why the process of releasing the report took time is because we were not sure whether there were elements in the Mivan report that might have compromised the establishment of Good Bank. After considering the matter, we were of the view that the release of the Mivan report will not compromise the establishment of Good Bank. The next step that we had to do is to consult the Minister of Finance. We consulted the Minister of Finance. And together with the Minister of Finance, we agreed on a process whereby we would allow people who are named in the report. There were 37 people that were named in the report. It was in conjunction with the Minister of Finance that the Registrar of Banks decided on a process whereby we would allow the 37 people who were named in the report to look at the report before we made it public. The Minister of Finance was then replaced in December. In some ways, we had to go through a consultation process again, which was in some ways impacted by the budget and the roadshow immediately after the budget. But once we were able to consult the Minister of Finance and go through that process of allowing the 37 people who were named in the report to have a look at the report, and there was no legal challenges, we decided to lift the confidentiality of the report. And we lifted it on the 12th of May this year. As soon as we lifted the confidentiality of the report, we forwarded the report to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. When I say we, the Registrar of Banks, forwarded it to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. It is now up to the NDPP to decide if there is anyone to prosecute, or any person to prosecute, or any action. It is quite likely that some investors may take the report and use it as evidence against certain board members or executives in a civil suit if they felt that the losses that they incurred were as a direct result. When there was a sale in Regal Bank. I think it was 1999, 2000. It took 11 years to prosecute Mr. Levinstein. 11 years. These things do take long. I'm not justifying the length of time. It's a long, complex period. It is the NDPP would have to go through the report and decide if there is a case to be made or if anybody needs to be prosecuted, because I fully agree with you. Why we must not try to find blame. If there are people who did wrong, then they must be held accountable. And we hope that that process will proceed. But it's not up to us to decide that. Exactly. If people had done wrong, if people were negligent, if people were reckless, they must be held accountable, and they must be seen to be held accountable in the eyes of the justice. It's in the interest of justice for them to be held accountable.
I just want to make one point. The witnesses or the traditional stakeholders were not consulted in terms of whether the report should be made public or not. They were given the opportunity to have a final review and a final view of the report because of legal implications it may have on individuals and institutions. But definitely the consultation was between the Register of Banks and the Minister of Finance and not with the witnesses.
Thank you. Let me move to Mr. Butteleri's question. Let me deal with what Mr. Butteleri's issues. Interesting evidence. It is true that the Reserve Bank approved the acquisition of evidence. In hindsight, that was a mistake. In hindsight, it increased the risk in the bank. At the time, the economy was booming. The furniture industry was doing incredibly well. Canadians had made R1 billion profit. And the bank, the African bank, then applied to the Reserve Bank for permission to acquire Canadians. It was with the understanding of the Reserve Bank that the board had approved it and there had been a thorough due diligence done. It appears from the Mudberg report that that was not the case, that there was no board approval, there was no board resolution, and that there was no proper due diligence done. But the Reserve Bank approved that on the assumption that the board had approved it and the board had approved it after a thorough due diligence. But yes, I think that that was one of the things that went wrong. On the role of internal auditors and external auditors, and again, let me deal with one of Makosi's questions on what is the distinction between prudent and aggressive accounting policies. Paragraph 35 of the executive summary says the following. The bank's impairment practices were aggressive in comparison with the banking industry as a whole. Impairment practices are when you decide to put money aside for a possible loss. So let's assume that I've given you R100 loan, and you must pay, R1,000 loan, and you must pay me R100 a month for 12 months. After 3 months, you pay the first month, you pay the second month, you pay the third month, the fourth month you don't pay. Now I stand to lose, I could potentially lose some money. Maybe you start paying again in month 5, maybe you don't. At some point, I as a bank must say, I might lose the remaining 9 months of payments. And so I must start to provide for it on my balance sheet. I must start to make a provision that customer X is likely to miss or not to repay this loan. The outstanding value of the loan is X. I must make a provision against my balance sheet. Some banks do this immediately. So you miss 1 month's payment, they put money aside, they put cash aside, right, in case you don't pay the loan. If you do pay, then it's a bit of an upshot on the profit line, but if you don't pay, I'm protected, I'm provided for. According to the Marburg report, the impairment practices were aggressive in relation to other banks. So that's why now I use the word aggressive. It's purely on the accounting standards of when you impair something. Is it after 1 month? Is it after 2 months? Is it after 4 months? Is it after 6 months?
when you're impaired. Even if a loan is impaired, even if a person has not paid for 6 months and a loan is gone bad, it doesn't mean that the bank does not try to recover some of the money. Sometimes they try to recover some of the money themselves. Sometimes they sell the book to a debt recovery practitioner. And I think people in this room know that some of the practices that debt recovery practitioners use are not always wholesome. They're not always wholesome. There's a big problem on regulation of those entities. But any bank would attempt to recover and would take reasonable steps to recover. But sometimes you do have to write it off completely. But the accounting practice says you must provide for it fairly early on in the process. The distinction here that the Maurik report is making is that African banks were making provisions later than was the norm in the banking sector. Yes, I fully agree with you that the whole Board of ABEL has fiduciary responsibility. Do you know much about the internal practices? Let's come back to that. That the whole Board of ABEL has fiduciary responsibility. And one of the things that went wrong here is that the Board did not exercise its fiduciary oversight. There is a specific issue about the acquisition of LREs where the board did not exercise their fiduciary oversight. There is also a specific issue with regards to the loan to LREs from the bank that the board didn't exercise its fiduciary oversight. Right? And the third generalization that Advocate Myberg makes, is that in general the board did not sufficiently question the CEO. Any good company, you have to have a board that questions the CEO. They might be the best friend of the CEO. They might have gotten very rich from the CEO's performance. But they must still question the CEO. Right? There must still be the nagging voice that says, is this prudent? Is this right? And in this case, the board didn't do that. The question of interconnectedness is an interesting issue that you raise. Since the financial crisis, much of the financial sector regulatory reform agenda has moved to reduce interconnectedness and to prevent the too big to fail problem. And so in South Africa, we have also taken steps to prevent the too big to fail problem. We have increased capital requirements in the banks as we implemented Basel III. We have introduced a liquidity requirement for the banks. And we will introduce a net stable funding ratio to ensure adequate maturity mismatches from 2018. All to prevent banks from failing and to minimize the systemic risk that large banks pose. South Africa's banks, the big four, are very large. They do have a systemic risk to the financial sector. And it's our job to attempt to manage that systemic risk and to ensure that we minimize the systemic risk to the financial sector. Does that imply a moral hazard? We hope not. We hope that the steps that we've put in place in the regulatory reform in the last 7-8 years has minimized the moral hazard. But yes, I think it's fair to say that in general, all over the world, big banks have operated on a license that says, well, if we fail, the government will bail us out, and if we make profits, we'll keep the profits. Right? That has been the practice in the banking sector. I don't think we are completely eliminated, but we have gone a long way towards eliminating the moral hazard risk. Because again, I agree with you that we have made progress, both in securing the financial sector and in the resolution of African Bank. You say you hoped that SARB had intervened earlier. As the Maverick report shows, it was as early as 2011 where we put the bank under intensive supervision. Yes, you could very legitimately say, should we have acted earlier, should we have put the bank in the curatorship earlier? That's a very legitimate question to ask. And again, I think it's necessary for the Reserve Bank to reflect on those issues, to reflect on how we would do things differently if they were to occur again. However, again, I want to repeat that distinction between the responsibility of the supervisor and the responsibility of managers in the economy, or of boards, of CEOs, of people. There is a line that we don't want to cross. We we don't want to take over responsibility for running the banks. We don't have the ability or capability or skills to do that. Right? Banks employ very smart people and a lot of money to do that, to manage the risks. Our job is to ensure that they comply with the law, that they are safe and they're sound, and they're managed and they're governed in a sound way. And the African Bank is clearly an example where things can go wrong.
Just to respond on when should the Reserve Bank have intervened. Now, the Deputy Governor and I had already mentioned that there was intensive supervision since 2011. And there's a fine line that you have to keep on when to intervene. If you look at Section 69, it says you can only put a bank into curatorship if the bank is unable to meet its liabilities in the future. And if you don't apply that test correctly, you could be in breach of your regulatory duties and actually put a bank into curatorship that should not be put into curatorship. So I just wanted to make that the point as well. The Act just specifies when to intervene and when not to intervene, specifically on curatorship.
On the both, Makosi and Tandy raised issues of the structural problems in the economy, the underlying causes of it. I do think that South Africa is a nation of consumers rather than savers. That's part of the problem. And yes, it's part of the problem, and it's made worse by the fact that we've got low levels of employment, and many people are on what I would call precarious employment. You get a job here for a few months and a job there, and that adds to this culture of consumption, culture of credit. I think, and the politicians have put a lot of pressure on the policymakers over the last two decades to enhance financial inclusion. Right? There's been a lot of pressure to enhance financial inclusion, which is a good thing. But financial inclusion has to be seen as beyond credit. Right? Financial inclusion has to include transactional banking, access to the payment system, access to remittances, access to medical insurance, access to pension funds, access to unemployment insurance. All of those must be seen as financial inclusion. And I think if we take a financial inclusion lens that is broader, that looks at all of these things, I think we'll be doing something right. I think if you only look at access to credit, then you will get into problems, right? Because the politicians on the one end are saying, some politicians are saying, no, you must enhance access to credit. And then you force the banks into relatively risky sectors, and then when the banks get into trouble, you have a public problem. I do think you have to balance that with a broadening of access to financial services, including savings products, including pension, including insurance products. Why do small farmers, can they not insure against drought? Small farmers, that should be a financial inclusion issue. So if a drought hits, the farmer doesn't have to go to a bank and take out a loan. If it's a small farmer, they should be able to get crop insurance or livestock insurance. And I think a broader focus on financial inclusion can help mitigate some of those risks that you speak about the structure of our economy contributing towards a problem. Conglomerate supervision, I agree. I think that there are risks that conglomerates bring to the economy, and financial conglomerates in particular, and the relationships between financial companies, and we think that financial sector regulation will enhance our supervision on them. Chair, on Capitec, and there were two questions on Capitec. The SARB will not comment in public about our view on any bank. Right? Neither will we make public any actions that we take on any regulated entity. Right? Unless we've imposed a fine for anti-money laundering or any other type of business and we choose to make that public, we will not say publicly what we think about a bank, because that would introduce systemic risk into the banking sector in and of itself. So we will not comment publicly on any bank or make any public announcement about any supervisory discussion that we have with banks. I can assure you that the SARB is an inclusive supervisor. We are monitoring all of the banks, all of the entities that we are regulating, and where we find problems, we raise those in a timely fashion with the executives and the board of banks. When is IFRS 9 coming? In 2019, South Africa will adopt something called International Financial Reporting Standard 9, IFRS 9. Right? IFRS 9 will be a standard that will regulate how the banks score impairments. It's called a credit loss model. or an expected loss model, and the banks will be forced to have specific models for when they make provisions for bad debt and loans. And we would have to audit those models. We would have to supervise those models. We think that that will introduce a greater degree of rigor in how the banks deal with accounting practices. Denzel has outlined some of the risks of intervening too early. Just on non-performing loans, we do attempt to recover. Let me be specific. In that book, there is 17 billion rands worth of loans, of which we think it is possible to recover about 7 billion. Have I got the numbers right?
Yeah,
about
5.6. So the SARB don't cover the total SARB loan of 3.3 billion. Will then be fully, how can I say, covered in terms of what we expect on the 5.6.
On when we are likely to exit our stake in Good Bank, I think, because you're absolutely right, when we feel the system's right place, when we feel the bank is stable and on its feet, when there's good governance, and when we think that selling our stake will not increase risks to the bank or to the financial sector, we will exit. So that's broadly the criteria that we use. Pinky raised points about the Twin Peaks framework, and let me tie that up, I guess, with the last question asked by the chair. What else we could do in the FSR bill to reduce risks? It's a slightly difficult question to ask, but largely because I think the FSR bill is very well crafted. But I think that financial sector policy coordination in government is probably still a bit fragmented. Greater coordination on financial sector policy between various policymakers and regulators would help to get greater coherence in the sector. I've mentioned issues about fit and proper persons test. We have tightened our criteria there on fit and proper persons test. Andy, thank you for the compliments. I think that I do think we've got good financial sector in South Africa. I think it's well regulated. I think it's well capitalized. I think we're doing that balance right between broadening financial access to financial services and ensuring the safety and soundness of the financial sector. But yes, we do have a country with high unemployment, and that does add pressure to the financial sector. We are constantly engaged with banks about those stresses. Chair, I think I've covered all of them. I want Denzel to come back on the internal audit issues in African Bank.
In terms of the role of the internal audit and external audit, one has to look at in terms of the total governance structure. So if you have a weak or a weaker, how can I say, audit committee in the sense of providing direction to the internal audit department and setting an audit plan for the next year. If that is not appropriate, you're likely to get into a space where you will not be focusing on the right things. I will not be commenting on the external auditors issue because there's some litigation in the process in terms of the external auditors of the previous bank.
Alright, it's 11:45. Doesn't mean therefore that we continue to run. But I noticed Mr. Mania, Sandy. Yeah, you can ask that. I'm sure other people are going to say the same. So, are you a member of Parliament? Sorry.
General.
In the National Assembly.
Yeah.
I didn't speak to me from the NGOP. I've never seen you before. Sorry. Yeah, I know. I mean, the thing is that he's entitled. I don't make the rules. It doesn't matter whether he's an interest or doesn't, or which committee comes from. Welcome. You're a new member. You came in 2014. And you're in the Trade and Industry Committee. Yeah, you can ask anything you want. Sure. You're right.
Yeah.
Okay, so in order that we recognize.
Let's remind them.
question there.
Yeah, okay,
since you're
very nice.
Come to the
services.
I'm saying the question is referring to the services. Yeah? It's a, I said there's a reason why I'm very interested in the two senior debt holders in yeah. DRD. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I want to come back to two of my questions which were partially answered. The first is on the appointment of Tommy Sokutu. What could possibly have caused the Reserve Bank thoughts that Mr. Sokutu, even although he might have been a senior civil servant, could possibly have equipped himself as a chief risk officer with, at least on the version provided by in the report, with no significant experience in private sector, no significant experience in banking, and no significant experience as in managing risk in banks. But more particularly, the question I pose to you on this matter is specifically, who interviewed Mr. Sokutu? Who approved Mr. Sokutu's appointment, and when was it done? So that was a specific question. And I'm just waiting for. Okay. Thank you. I can hear the grumbling, but at the end of the day, the report says that the Reserve Bank endorsed the appointment. Now, if that's the case, who interviewed him and who approved that endorsement? That's my question. And my question was not whether you would concede that the Reserve Bank are complicit in the collapse of African Bank. My question was whether you would concede that the Reserve Bank erred in endorsing the appointment of Mr. Sokutu, which subsequently was one of the factors leading to the collapse of the African Bank. So, specific question. Okay. Then let me come to the whole question of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, which you again partially answered. If you scrutinize the Act, in your reply you seem to suggest, first, that the Reserve Bank has discretion as to whether the report should or should not be sent to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. And that furnishing the report to the National Director of Public Prosecutions is contingent on the report being made public. In fact, if you look at the Act, it appears to me that the onus is on the Commissioner to make a copy of the report available to the National Director of Public Prosecutions. Now, my reading of the Act is that the report in February 2015 ought to have been furnished, not by the Reserve Bank, by the Commissioner, to Registrar, the Minister, and National Director of Public Prosecutions, given its findings in respect of 11C and D about negligence, business being conducted negligently and recklessly. So, in your reply, you've conceded that, in fact, the National Director of Public Prosecution would only receive a report sometime after it was made public on the 12th of May. And then my question still stands. Why was a report, why did the Commissioner, or perhaps the Reserve Bank, not furnish the National Director of Public Prosecutions with a copy of the report in February 2015, as they were required to by the Bank Act? That's my question. Then my last question, Chair, is the process which the Reserve Bank followed after they received the report. Now, my understanding is that a draft report was produced by the Commission on the 12th of January 2015. Subsequent to that, the 37 witnesses to which you refer were provided with an opportunity to comment on the report. And as you correctly point out, some witnesses made adverse comments. But based on those comments, and based on the process which was then presumably instituted so that to cater for procedural fairness, a final report is furnished to the registrar, to the Reserve Bank. When the Reserve Bank subsequently decides to replicate the process and provide the witnesses with an opportunity to comment on the final report submitted by Myburg. So my question is, did the Reserve Bank, as a result of the submissions from the 37 witnesses, substitute their findings or make any alterations to the final report furnished to the Reserve Bank by Myburg? What I'm getting at, is this the Myburg report, or is this the Reserve Bank's version of the Myburg report?
But it's really quite simple. I mean, committees, there's no reason why. There's no law that says the committee cannot be offered to reinforce one's sense of importance. But it's very simple. This is the Myburg report, right, Cindy? Is that correct? There's no need for you to answer this. No need. On committee's failure, I think underpinning it is an insult, actually, to you. I'm not going to allow that question. I don't care who says what, you can go to whichever court you want. We asked the Myburg report. You see, if it was asked by somebody other than Mr. Mania, it would not imply that you just, once again, somebody who's dishonest, incompetent, probably corrupt, because it's a corruption. For you, Cindy, and for the Reserve Bank governor to present a report of Parliament that is not a Myburg report, you can do that and say to us, this is the Reserve Bank's version of the Myburg report. These are the reasons why we cannot give you the Myburg report. And then hand over to Frank Jenkins, not any member of Parliament, to Frank Jenkins, a lawyer, who advises us, and then members can respond and bring their own legal opinions. But I think that's an insulting question. You don't have to answer it. I'm answering it. Cindy's answering. There's no need for you to answer it. It's below your dignity to answer such ridiculous questions. It's ruled out. As far as I know, this is a Reserve Bank, I mean, this is a Myburg report. You're accountable to Parliament, right? Good, let's move on. Next is Handy.
Yes, sir, I was wondering that if it was me who was so much, you would have intervened very early. I don't know what David Bodily was.
I'm the chair. Nothing stops you now from raising issues about the racialized nature and the subject of what Mr. Miller constantly raised as well. I'm a Marxist. I don't use that race term easily. But there's a pattern here, right? And really, the committee chairs have no choice. I have no rule that guides me, except I'm doing it now in this case. It's the first time I'm doing it, and if the racism is a minia about how he polarizes this committee, and his oversight role becomes very dilutive, people don't take him seriously, and I'll advance. And he doesn't want to listen. I can do nothing. I'm not his whip. He can do whatever he wants, but as long as he abides by the rules. And I'm very clear. Given the racial tenderhoods of which this society is, this idea, wherever it comes from, that black people, Africans in particular, are inherently corrupt, right? Are inherently corrupt, are inherently incapable of governing, are inherently to be treated as suspicious, is very different from rigorous oversight that opposition members, the committees that I've served as chair, I think I'm the longest serving chair here, since 1998, actually, right? Is this correct? Right. I've never had this experience before. And we've got it now, and my job is to actually extensively learn the, not just the rules of Parliament, but its spirit. And quite frankly, I think the system is just, in the context of the same person repeatedly raising these issues, it is not acceptable. Somebody else had asked, maybe I would have let it pass. It's a fair question to ask without all the innuendos it contains. So, hey, I'm saying it's out. Time is over to you.
Before I ask a question, I just want to
object to your constant suggestion that my questions, or that the themes or the direction that my question takes and motivated are racist. I am asking, I haven't had the experience of members asking tough questions. I'm sorry.
Please, you are not an Amir Tariat, you are not a Peter Smith, you are not a Colin Eglin.
right? So don't flatter yourself. You're not a dean monk, actually. Many of your listeners are frankly idiotic, right? But I allow them because I have no choice. You love yourself. That's your right. That's between you and your therapist. But you can't use this parliamentary committee. It's not a therapy session.
Please don't be last-minute.
No, I'm the chair. I'm saying very clearly, be clear what I said. I did not say you're a racist. I said there's a racial subtext. There's an inherent suspicion that black people in general, Africans in particular, right? Where else in the world, look at this fellow. Look at him. Look at their ages. Where else in the world do you find the competence? Well, I haven't heard you, but I've heard you in a different context. I know you. Maybe you don't know me, but I've heard you before. I look at these two. Where else in the world would you get people of this caliber at this age? And his point is right. 5 years from now, these people will be outstanding in their roles. Right? Both of them who answered have been very competent. There's not even one with iota of acceptance. You know what? I disagree with you guys, but hey, there are many things you said that are good. That's your right. I can't stop you. But I can't stop you from polarizing this committee on racial grounds. That's what I'm saying you're doing. Whether you're doing it wittingly or unwittingly, fine. And you can express your opinion. It's not going to change the view of a majority of us about you. But move on to Tari.
Thanks, I was right about my time because sometimes I'm told that I speak for long, so I don't understand why do you allow David to hit our blood with such content. I won't take it. Can I make a comment before I go to the question I wanted to ask? And this is related to the lipstick governor. Sometimes when we as members ask questions, we don't ask questions in good faith. So what you say in the hindsight might be part of the things that will be used in court of laws by certain members. If you look closely at the line of questioning, it suggests that people are trying to gather enough information to be utilized in litigation processes. And I'll make an example why I did so. You see, when you want to know whether there's been amendments to the Maybeck report, whether based on the engagement with the 37 witnesses, there's been changes. That is a legal question, right? It's not based on generally trying to look at the systemic challenges faced by the supervision of banks. It's got nothing to do with supervision of banks. It's a legal question. So sometimes we take advantage of the fact that you come before us to present in confidence, confidential information, sensitive to the market, and we use it for other reasons. So that's my comment. To my second comment, I'm actually very happy that when you spoke to the issue of financial inclusion, you were able to pick up on what I've always raised in my early days in the Youth League, what I used to call as conscious consumption in our society, in that basically we don't have clear programs. And I know it's not the work of SAB to go to public to encourage people to save good investments and so on. I used to take people to task and say, is it genuine to invest in a Louis Vuitton belt that's not necessarily qualitative going forward, when could have used that to invest in immovable assets and so on, and there were different opinions and so on. But one thing I've observed, and it's maybe the psychological issue, people have been impoverished for very long. Once they have access, the first thing they want to do is to emulate the life of the rich, in a way, and it has taken us and it's challenged that we'll find a way in our political engagement to try. But the question comes from, when banks tried to, and led to, when LLMs were making high profit margins, do you see a situation where banks will want to maximize profits by taking higher risk, and the type of systems, and maybe when we look at the financial regulation sector, we look at a specific, well, we might not put it in a clause of an act of parliament, but we might want to put in a guideline that says there should be a particular monitoring at the profit margins of the performance of banks when it's starting to go to another direction where it wants to maximize profit and taking a higher risk. And I know it's different, and it's an issue that I want us to bring back to the table. You see, it relates to how others perceive your role as a supervisory institution, because they think that you should manage banks and you supervise. Supervision and management is two different. You can't send management letters. You can't. you have to look at the finer details of what they do, except to look at the broad policy framework of the... So I want to come back to that, because the confusion lies there. There is a line of question that says, shouldn't you have sent the matter to the NPPA? It must be very clear that you caution, and maybe that's the word that we might not be using in this meeting, you caution the behavior of banks. It is going to create a risk factor for the economy of the country as a matter of principle. But the total governance structure is the responsible party to the overall performance, and there's broad lines of understanding in that regard. And can you imagine, I'm trying to raise an argument here, can you imagine if SAP can mitigate banks for having failed? It will not be a supervisory role anymore. You'll be taking the justice system's role to say whether an act of corruption or mismanagement or recklessness has taken place in a legal framework. And jurisprudence will not allow you to take the purview, in my opinion. So if you can clear that part, it will also help us, because we're going to deal with the fintech legislation. We don't want to get into that space when there's still confusion around the role of SAP. To a point that blame is apportioned to SAP when it's unnecessarily supposed to go to SAP. And I'm saying, and I'm happy that you're going to be the registrar of banks, because then you're going to use a different culture altogether at how bank managers look at the role of government. Because the fact that they take a risk knowing that they'll be bailouts from government, we need to put some measure of limiting that risk. Because as a result, the public purse that will intervene, it depends in all our banks. So, and how are we going to intervene as and when it happens? People doing it knowing that in any way, it will affect the good government to intervene. So it's not a mistake, it's a temporary effort by certain individuals, and not unskilled individuals. Unskilled individuals who take those economic questions. We can borrow ideas from what happened in other banks all over the world. It wasn't black, unskilled people who took such decisions. Thank you.
Lewis, you said you wanted to ask.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity, and thank you, Deputy Governor. I want to focus once again, if I may, on the question of reckless lending by African Bank. I know that you dealt with this in the Trade Industry Committee, but at that point the report, I think it had been released the previous evening. So I've now had a chance to read the report in detail, and it's clear that the Commissioner did not investigate reckless lending, and he explains why, and I understand his explanations. I also understand very well your explanation and the predicament that you are in, that you require collateral for your loan, and that to do away with that collateral or write off that collateral would be very damaging and prejudicial to your position and indeed to the fiscus. However, my concern remains that we are creating a perverse incentive in South Africa whereby many of those non-performing loans, or at least a very significant portion of them, are originally illegitimate and reckless loans, and have trapped sometimes very poor people, or as you quite correctly describe them as, I forget the word that you use, but uncertainly employed people, in a debt trap which they can't escape, and which now essentially they owe that money to you as the Reserve Bank, and which money you are pursuing as a collateral for your loan. Now we know that there is at least a lot of prima facie evidence that there was widespread reckless lending taking place in African Bank. We have the 699 cases found at the Dundee branch. That's one tiny branch, a tiny case in town, 699 examples of reckless lending. There's numerous high court cases and tribunal cases, which all the documents are in the public record. I found one, for example, of a civil servant in Gauteng who was taking home 16,000 rand a month and who had African Bank payments of 13,000 rand a month, leaving him with a disposable income of 3,000 rand a month with which to live. This is the kind of lending that is going on. Now, I don't think it's right that those kind of loans are used as collateral for your loan. I think we have an ethical and, in fact, a legal obligation under the National Credit Act to try to separate those loans which were legitimate bona fide loans and those loans which, at the time of the loan being made, were reckless. The NCA, I think, places a responsibility on us to do that. And when I asked you this question in August 2015, sorry, not you personally, but the SOB representative who was at our committee on that particular occasion, I was told that that investigation was being done. Now, I'm not sure if that gentleman misspoke or whether he was referring to the curator, Mr. Winterberg, but it's quite clear that the commission was not doing that investigation. So I want to have this debate with you because I just don't think it's good enough to say that we have to continue to pursue those reckless loans and those borrowers to repay them just because it's collateral for your loan. I want us to investigate and to go through those credit agreements one by one to separate the good bona fide loans from the reckless loans, to apply to the Consumer Tribunal to have, or to the High Court as the Act allows, to have those reckless loans written off. And if anyone needs to, if you need collateral for your loan and you need to pursue anyone for that collateral, then you must pursue ultimately the major shareholders and the superior and subordinate debt holders of African Bank for that collateral. You should not pursue over-indebted poor South Africans who were given reckless loans when they couldn't afford it. Thank you.
Sir, there is something that I think was said which is very important, and I think we need to take that forward. And that is the fragmentation that exists in terms of how we approach the entire financial sector. I think we need to find a way of probably starting to engage with National Treasury so that we can deal with those areas that are fragmented. And the reason why I'm saying that, Jay, is because if one listens to the nature of the questions that are coming forward, some of the questions you can see that they are channeled to SAF, but I think the most appropriate entity that should be asked those questions is the National Credit Regulator. And at the end, I also think that we cannot run away from the fact that some members have a tendency of having subjects in their engagement, and they will call that, brutal engagement, the tough questions and what have you. And I don't think they actually draw a line between an insult and something like that. Number one, my understanding is that there are quite a number of key individuals at African Bank. And I don't think Mr. Shoft was the only key individual that could be found wanting. In the first instance, even though they can show stress, that governance, the board, was not exercising, was not performing its discretionary duty over the CEO. Now, for you to be able to isolate Shoftu alone, and then you then say, he has no experience with the private sector. He has, you come with all these things so charged, emotionally charged things. It does actually say something else. The other thing he said in this meeting, Madhulani and Brandon, they would ask questions, very tough questions, but the approach they use is very different from David. David tends to actually go about it, about to show himself. I mean, I think he takes pride in the fact that he has found a black African who is not competent. It sounds like that sometimes when he speaks. Even the fact that he is telling us that we are not tough enough, we don't ask us enough questions. To me, I take exception to that. Number one, we have PIC here, And we did actually hold the PIC to account why they actually increased their investment in after when they knew that it was not doing well, it was not doing well. Now we portray yourself as this master builder and with these absolutely fantastic solutions to all the problems in South Africa. And we can't take that, Chair. I don't think we should allow that in this committee, and I don't think we should allow David to continue with his approach, because he is smart by doing that. And he is not sensitive to the fact that some of us are very proud and we believe that we are competent. And if to him our questions are not as tough, I'd love to him. He must take his tough questions home. He must not bring them here. You know, if their questions are meant to insult us, because we can't allow that. So the thing that I wanted to stress here is that, you know, the question that has been raised by the previous speaker on the recovery of those loans from those, poor South Africans who have no means of actually paying them back. I think we do need to find a way of how best we can address this without getting into the operational space. We are policymakers. We can't get into the operational space because the operational space is meant for people like you. Our role is really to perform our fiscal oversight in terms of policies and so forth. But in as far as this operational space impacts on the overall picture, we do need to advise you to say probably you need to find a way of how you best you can address that. And I also don't think that it's a good idea to say simply because somebody is, there has to be a lot of education in the first instance to make sure that our people are not only looking at or don't consider financial inclusion from the credit access point of view, and I think you've made that point very well, and I wish National Treasury was here, because I think sometimes I get the sense that they tend to, they're not necessarily National Treasury, but most of us tend to think that financial inclusion is about credit access, and credit access is just one aspect of it, and that aspect is actually a very risky aspect. Probably we need to start addressing the demand side of the economy, and I keep remembering on that point that the demand side of the economy, we don't address it, we always address the supply side of the economy, which is obviously consumptive, we become over-consumptive and so forth and so forth. I think that is very important. But the major point, Chair, that I wanted to raise is that, Chair, please reprimand David Nye, because we cannot allow ourselves to continuously be insulted by this man in this meeting.
Yeah.
No, Chair, I think so that's the thing that has been covered. Whenever there's a thing that people I think are very quick to point to a similar direction. It comes to my question, that's why I spoke about the internal audit, that's why I spoke about the final audit, because all these people, they should work directly with the chief risk officer in a company. So things went wrong there. So whether a timing of interview by whom is neither here nor there. In fact, you may even go to a sense of who interviewed the board and start looking to see that all those people who are in the board, who are in the head community. So again, I think when we are going to see that these are government structures, and I think the answer that just come from, the answer just come from ARB, is that there was a failure, of the government structure from the board to the subcommittees, from the board to the executives and so on. It can't be put on the doorstep of only the chief risk officer. Let me again put this clear, like I know it's not my favorite person, right? But what is happening here is very sensitive stuff. Let's do interviews, tell us, even then go to home management. Because a chief risk officer reports to the ex-host of that organization, the corporate responsibility to also ask the chief risk officer, even the audit committee, myself, even the internal audit committee, even the auditors. So it's just a sort of a systematic failure of government structure throughout, not trying to put the thing at the doorstep of just running this. I mean, unfortunately, can't come and answer for himself here. So let's just assert the right on the thing that comes from the public, because of the general government failure, corporate government failure in this organization. And people are responsible for that, should be able to take a collective responsibility. They can't be holding themselves behind the person who's departed. So I just want to say that when we look at this thing outside of this chair, right, we need to be very holistic. Let's be very holistic. This question of to visit at each where is not here nor there. I think it's also coming up from the CEO. You know, you ask the same question about the CEO. So I just thought, not going to write my piece of thread, we should be very careful of these aspects which are there, but it's which what time I was responsible for the fear of it.
Also, I think it's a bit unfair when people are not here in this committee to speak for themselves, right? And this is the person that's passed on. But even if he hadn't, the second thing I would like to suggest is perhaps just focus, you can answer where you want, whatever you want, focus on how can we avoid inappropriate people being appointed, given the lessons you had with African Bank, so that we don't have this situation again. Now, if you, it may be, I don't know, suggestion that this kind of comrade suddenly put him in the bank. I find that hard to believe. I mean, you see, it's like saying, okay, this guy has got a job, let's give him a job as a pilot in the SAA. You know, so he flies his plane. Which person is going to get out of the plane? You know? So this idea of data deployment, I mean, in the minds of some physicians, probably one of them here, but I don't know. I said, probably, but listen, if you want to be precise, and you want to be clear and rooted, and on the ball, you must hear what people are saying. And the choice of words is very clear. Nobody said he's a racist. People come to that conclusion individually. And I warned you about that as a committee chair. I'm talking about the racial stuff here. Innuendo, maybe somebody can look it up in a dictionary. You're quite young, inexperienced. Oversight didn't start when you came to Parliament. I think you're a new MP. You should look at the record, see what DA members have done. And they've been bloody good, some of them in the committee. That's they've shaped the outcomes of bills. Your 1 year tenure, frankly, you plus for something that's wrong with the list, and on the unlisted, but you think we were not going to ask it. Okay, you can try to co-chair with your letter, which is an inappropriate letter. You can't decide. Let me just tell you something, Mr. A. You cannot co-chair. You cannot write to a minister or deputy minister and say, flowing from the meeting, with that, trying to think of this. You can write a question to the House and ask a minister whatever you want. You can't take over the responsibility of the committee secretary and the chair. But I will discuss that with you outside this meeting. What I'm saying is the main thing that's coming out, I think, you can answer whatever you want, is to say, having learned the lessons, even from the appointment of Sami Subutu, it's not about him as an individual. It's what are you going to do to prevent that happening? But before you tie up, Ms. Lee said he's had up for some while. Over to you. On our report, right? So we have to end by about 10 to 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but as you left me behind, I won't be able to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't feel startled, and so I shall speak for a relatively short while, as is my wont. And Mr. Chairman, I also take umbrage with you, because I disagree with you. I think that the three persons sitting opposite us are competent as we speak. It's not going to take another 5 years before they become competent. But that was their tongue in cheek, Mr. Chairman. I have no doubt they will. But, you know, when you get to yours and my age, Mr. Chairman, perhaps our competence levels are dropping somewhat. And so there must be some top there. Yes, sir. So I don't choose to put myself in any better position than the gentleman opposite me. Mr. Chairman, I think that one must be cautious about taking umbrage when a particular member of this committee focuses on what we hear for today, which is the African Bank. And that is our role here today, is to focus on the bank and to see what's happened, what we think may have gone wrong, and find out how we can try to prevent it in the future. So
so that's agenda, our role here, and yes, so I think that we have different ways of approaching that, but I think we all have a genuine wish to accomplish those goals. Mr. Chairman, I was a bit concerned when the question of haptic back was raised, and I'm very pleased that Ruben has taken the position he had, because I just checked, I can't find anything negative, and I'd hate for there to suddenly be a run on the bank because this committee is putting out suggestions that the bank is not stable. In fact, the share price has gone up again today, so perhaps I should have bought shares yesterday, and I would have made a bit of money out of it. So, Mr. Chairman, in just in general, I really do think that this committee has had an enormous task, and the Reserve Bank has an enormous task, but I think that working together as we have done, that we have great levels of confidence in the Reserve Bank, we can make every effort. That's Kevin's right. We can't guarantee these things don't happen again. They may well happen again. But it's our responsibility, together with the Reserve Bank, to take action which would minimize those events happening again. Thank you.
If I merely asked a question, Mr. Lee. I didn't know. I saw something in Business Day, which I should be more cautious about. I'm not suggesting anything wrong. But I think you were quite right to draw my attention to that. Maybe I handled it clumsily, but it wasn't any suggestion the bank is going wonky or anything. There's so much, there's other more to ask. What was the country called? But look, I withdraw what I said, just to be safe. Can we hand over to you? We've got about 15 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, yes.
No, Chair, first of all, I wanted to apologize. I lost my cool. I think I shouldn't have reacted the way I did, but I lost my cool because David sometimes, you know, he goes into spaces that we don't want to venture into. Chair, on a serious note, the deputy terms that they are going to increase or they are going to tighten the liquidity requirements, they are going to look at capital, they are going to also tighten the capital requirement, and also we said probably we need to look at the whole fit and proper. But my question is, when you do that, how are you going to ensure that it doesn't end up undermining the policy of government, even the structural deficiencies in our economy? As a good example, if you want to participate in the insurance space in South Africa, you probably need the capital requirement there at some stage. I think a few years ago it was around 12 million rand or something like that. And obviously it tends to, it excludes certain people. And unfortunately, the people that tend to be excluded are the black people. The very people that we are saying need to be brought in. And not just in the credit access space, but we also wanted them to be brought in the space where they are actually playing an active and meaningful role in the financial services space. So I just wanted to know, how are they going to ensure that while they are doing that, because it's important that it is done, we agree with that, because one of the shortcomings of APBIL, I think the liquidity asset was never really looked at, hence APBIL was just merely issuing out loan and not necessarily ensuring that, you know, the adequacy aspect is addressed. But we given the fact that we also needed to have more women in that space, in particular, I'm talking about women because women have been excluded. In fact, not just black women, even white women, to a very large extent, have been excluded in participating in the financial services space as shareholders and so forth and so forth. So how are you going to ensure that when you do that, you are not undermining that agenda, that bigger agenda? Thank you.
Chair, if I may just supplement my question with a 10-second comment and suggestion, I tend to agree with Ms. Kors, actually, that the most appropriate regulator is obviously the National Credit Regulator. The problem is that everyone seems to think that someone else is doing it. And so the NCR, the Commissioner, Mr. Winterboer, the Saab, so I'm not sure that we all agree that we should be investigating the reckless lending. But if we do agree, Deputy Governor, then may I suggest that you or the Saab pass on all of those credit agreements to the NCR and let them go through them and investigate them. They are proper regulated to do so. They will obviously need the source documents. So if you agree that we can investigate those, will you endeavor to ensure that those documents are passed on to them, and then they can spend the next 6 months going through those 3.3 million credit agreements one by one, which we must do to ensure that those very poor and vulnerable South Africans are not accountable for this mess up.
Just one quick thing I forgot to tell you guys. Your chairperson. Hey, your chairperson approached me. Just the name is John Fox. The eternal John Fox approached me to say that your National Credit Regulator, they've got some ideas, your committee, about enhancing their powers, right, strengthening them. And I saw on yesterday's business day, it seems that's going to go to Cabinet. I'm not sure how it affects any of the financial sector regulations, but I hope you guys are not agreeing at variance, you're sorting it out. Just alerting you, I'm waiting for that to come. Tell me, you have 30 seconds.
But just to that, if any matter of that nature, we'll have to discuss it with the Committee on Trade and Investment so that we should not...
Second meeting, the joint meeting in August. I spoke to your committee. We're asking your committee chair to come to a joint meeting. Obviously, you've got a million things to do. And may I say, I have the highest regard for your committee chair, and she works very hard. It's very difficult to...
And the reason why I was saying that, because I don't want sub and just like related to speaking in parallel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we're having a joint meeting with you guys. Okay, over to you.
In terms of the question on the who was the senior debt holders, it was mainly the asset management companies. In broad, mainly the asset management companies. To answer the question about what we do for patent proper testing. So, first of all, any board appointment or any executive appointment that reports directly to the CEO needs to come to the SARP. The Act is actually very clear that, so we don't approve the appointment, but we could actually object to the appointment. So the board would make the appointment, it will go through a board process, and the board decides whether this person is actually fit in order to perform the role within the organization. Then there's a certain procedure that must be completed, and a form is completed and submitted to the SARP, and then we have to decide whether we agree with the appointment or not. Obviously, we've learned lessons from what's happened in the past, and some of the processes that we're going through is that we get in the chair of the board and actually interview the board and see, for this appointment, what specific process did you go through in order to select an individual? Not just going through a CV and do the normal fit and proper checks, but also have an interview with the CEO and with the board members.
Just a precise date on when the SARB responded to the application of Mr. Sokoto as Chief Risk Officer, I'll have to get back to you. I'm happy to provide that to the Chair of the Committee in writing with the precise date. Many of the points were comments. Then this issue of maximizing profits by taking higher risks is a big problem in the financial sector, often because the profits are private and when there's losses, then it's for the taxpayer. And that's why you have to regulate the banks. And that's why you have to regulate them tightly, because you have to minimize, you have to change that incentive structure. You can't have a situation where when there are high profits and the executives and the shareholders get rich, and when profits fall and the bank gets into trouble, then it's for the society as a whole to...
And it's in the free market.
Exactly. You have to do that. And all the reforms that we've put in place over the last 7 or 8 years attempts to minimize the risk to the taxpayer of financial instability, of financial crises. We've attempted to minimize the chances that large and systemic banks will fail by raising the capital requirements. By increasing the liquidity requirements, by more tightly regulating them, by more tightly supervising them. We cannot provide a watertight guarantee. We will try our best, but we cannot provide a watertight guarantee. I think we have to continue that process of supervising and regulating the banks in a way that minimizes the risk, and that continue to do that. Because he then raises the interesting issue about these tighter regulations. Do they raise the barriers to entry? And does this prevent the system from being transformed in terms of an ownership sense? I think that's a very good, legitimate question to ask. How do you get the balance right between having very high barriers to entry to prevent fly-by-night operators becoming banks, but at the same time recognizing that you have to transform the financial sector so that both black people and women can get access not just to managerial positions, but ownership and control? I think that's a very genuinely good question to ask, and I think the answer lies in you have to have a combination of policies. You have to have tight regulations on the banks. You have to have very high capital requirements in the banks, but you also have to recognize that there has to be a degree of empowerment. I think the financial sector charter went a long way in that. I think the BEE codes go a long way in that. But I think either the banks and the banking system in general knows that there's still a lot more to do to increase the diversity of ownership and control of the financial sector. And I think that that might happen. It's an absolute imperative that we broaden ownership and control of the financial sector to the historically disadvantaged. There's no doubt about that. But it has to be done in a way that doesn't compromise the soundness and security of the financial sector, because often it's the poorest of the poor who will be impacted upon if we get that balance wrong. So it's a delicate balance. I think we're very mindful of that balance, and we are attempting to address that balance through a myriad of policy measures. We only apply one of those policy measures, but the Financial Services Board, the National Credit Regulator, the TGI to a certain extent, are all involved in an attempt to try and transform the financial sector. And they're absolutely right about that critical need. Mr. Lewis, on this issue around reckless lending and the debt trap, and are we pursuing money to cover our loan, the collateral for our loan, and are we pursuing poor people? We will not do anything unethical to attempt to recover money in bad book. We will adopt the highest ethical standards to attempt to recover money in bad book. At the moment, the law states, the National Credit Act states, that if a loan was found to be reckless, or if there were reckless lending, then that must be written off. Right? We can't do it willy-nilly. We can't say that the entire loan book or even the entire bad book was reckless lending, because I think that there are dangerous systemic implications of that. You have to have the competent authority with the National Credit Regulator to do the proper investigations to see, was there reckless lending? Is there a particular loan reckless, and if it was, then the law makes provision for that loan to be written off. In the particular case of what happened in Dundee, an African bank, there was a charge of reckless lending laid against African bank for the operations or for those loans that you mentioned in Dundee. African bank's argument was that it wasn't reckless lending, it was actually fraud, that the staff members involved committed fraud. African bank agreed to write off all the loans, and there was a settlement before it got to the tribunal, and they paid a $20 million fine in that regard. I don't think it would be fair to extrapolate that the entire loan book was reckless, because we have to maintain that very tight balance of access to financial services and financial inclusion versus locking out the poor completely. If we take rash steps by saying that all of these loans are reckless, the banks must write off all of these loans, there will be no lending to poor people. No lending in townships. Right? And the law has to be very careful, and the law strikes that balance between promotion of access to financial services but protecting the soundness and integrity of the financial sector. And I want to make that key, that we maintain that balance, because if we get that balance wrong, I think the financial sector will be weakened. If it was found that any of the loans in African Bank or any other bank were reckless by the competent authority, then those can be written off in terms of the National Credit Act. Full stop. I agree on the point on fragmentation. The over-indebtedness, I think there's a broader social question here that needs to be asked about how do we manage a society that's highly indebted. what do we do? If we write off people's loans, I think there's a problem on moral hazard for both the individual and the banks. If we don't write off people's loans, people who recently become unemployed and there's genuinely no means of payment, it causes a social problem. I think we've got to find social solutions. We've got to find political solutions to these problems. The solution can't be to just write them off. I fully agree with Honourable Buthelezi that there's a broader failure of corporate governance that led to those problems. You're absolutely right. It's a cascade of the corporate governance leading to the subcommittees around board risk, the culture of the bank, all of that was failed. I think Denzel has dealt with how we avoid inappropriate people on boards. I fully accept the spirit within which the committee has had engaged with us. What has gone wrong? How can we fix it? How can we make the financial system safer? And that's absolutely essential. And that's the spirit within which we've come to this engagement. We recognize that there were mistakes made, even in the South. There was something that has gone wrong. Our job is to try and find out what has gone wrong. How do we fix it? How do we make the system safer? And where there was genuine negligence, those people must be held accountable through a process of law. Thank you, Chair.
Tim, we're going to move into a different item, so you don't have to stay. Thank you very much. Very quickly, we have the report on the study tour we undertook. The report, see, the Finance Committee, we more than any other committee, should be held to account for funds that we use within Parliament. Indeed, these reports, in my view, from all committees should be submitted within a month of the study tour. But as you'll recall, there were some 6 weeks after the study tour that we were on constituency and family leave. But strictly speaking, starting from effectively end of January, this report should have been submitted end of February. I will not go into the details of what happened, Bridget left and so on. And then, of course, we decided that we can't proceed with the AFSR bill because we had the budget and we had then the Providence Fund bill, as I call it, and then we had to finish the FICA bill, which turned out to be far more onerous than we imagined. So in our case, it's understandable, but we need to explain, and we have done that somewhere, that the bill, somewhere you'll find it's there. Now, the report was sent to the participants in the study tour, so because they were there, and they will know most what's useful to add. But this part then, with the members, unfortunately, nothing came back to me. The first, up to page 15, halfway through 15, up to 4.13, it's an overview of what happened. May I suggest that the last conclusion is correct, then. It was very interesting, fascinating, rewarding. It turned out to be even more successful than anticipated. Yeah, I must say, you know, I've been on many study tours, needless to say. This is one of the more interesting ones. It wasn't quite the best, necessarily. But it was really interesting. For many of us, because we're not familiar in the technical sense of the financial sector, I really think it was really rewarding. Exactly how rewarding it seems to me will be clearer as we process the bill. Even where the context is different and the lessons they drew don't directly apply to us that we can translate, you learned a lot of things, really. It was really amazingly, I think, successful study tour. It's a bit pity, it's very pity we couldn't take the whole committee with us. So, going through this section, firstly, does anyone want to comment? I think it's a bit unfair to expect members who are not there to scrutinize every line. But the members who did go, it's really not acceptable that we didn't look at it carefully. It's really not acceptable. You know, people might laugh. It costs, I think, 140,000 runs per person, really. But, okay, having said that, is there any comment up to page 15?
Chairperson, I think this report covers broadly the activities that we were engaged in as the committee during that accession. So why do you want us to, because you, it's like we are not saying anything to it, because you know, we agree with what has been written here. It covers broadly all the things that we dealt with and the lessons learned. I mean, that's why Was it last week also when I said we need an ombudsman, because we also met these different ombuds there in the UK and we saw how they were able to interface with some of the students and even talk on the interests of the public. So Mina, I'm happy with this report. Unless it's telling
you. If that's the case, you could have written a reply to say you're happy with it, but it's amazing that a 21-page report is not a single thing that you could comment, especially the lessons. But that's fine, that's what you're saying.
Okay.
My own was a chair. I represent the committee and parliament as protection. It's unacceptable that all four other members that went didn't have a single thing to say. And you had plenty of time to do that. We asked you for your comments initially when the initial report was done. So let me not cover the ground. I do not accept what you're saying, Pinky, but it's your right to say it. It's my right to say the committee chair, I don't accept what you said. All right, let's put in the lesson plan. Any comments there? Pinky agrees all the lessons, presumably everybody else agrees, so I just want to ask permission, but I need to go through this because I did it in a great hurry, the lesson section. Just tightening it, don't change the language, doesn't affect quality decisions. This report will be kept with us as we process the bill. And in fact, all committee members are bound by this report because it's not a report. And so we look at this report more carefully. So what I'm asking for is some mandate. I will send you in tracking. You're not finished in the ATC, right? There will be a change to contest, but you'll see the little thing picked up already. Do you want to say something, Piki?
You know, there's something that you have also raised on page 17, but then is the South African model a strict 26 model after all?
Yeah.
You remember where we were saying it will be the SAP, your FHD, and where is the national regulator?
Yeah.
You remember all those things. And that's when we said we may talk Twin Peaks. And Floyd was also saying,
yeah.
You remember where Floyd was also saying, it's not a Twin Peaks per se, even when we're in the UK, it's not necessarily a Twin Peaks because of those other elements and so on. So to me, the way you have even put the question and how you are coming with those issues that you're picking up, it's very relevant. And I wish he was here, because he was also given the deputy governor. Remember, he was the one dealing with the Twin Peaks at some point at the South. So that question is also going to be nicer if we engage them on this approach.
I to ask in processing the bill that we will do it all. Anything else? So can we have a mover and a seconder, please? With the qualification, I will, don't put it for the ATC level. I have a time now, Friday morning. I'll look at it, yeah, and then I will. Then the next thing to say is, look, Alan was on leave. Well, not leaving, he's sick. So it's Monday. I've been very busy with a variety of things linked to this community. So it's only yesterday that we discovered that we released your questions, all of which you asked in the committee to the South African Revenue Service, and as well as Antonia pulled the questions together. I was hoping it would go out within 48 hours. Now, in fact, only yesterday morning, in exchange with Antonia, I discovered that Alan's sick, and wish, well, obviously for recovery, we discovered we hadn't locked the questions together. So I have sent you an appendix, and Antonia, just, I think all she did was take the exact wording. But if you want a copy of this speech, you can have it. There's no reason why I should doctor it. If I do, you can. Right. So it's been sent to her. What I'm asking for the committee, we said 10 days, right, from last Tuesday. But given that we gave it to you yesterday, I said let us have it by Friday. I would like to ask the committee, because I take ultimate responsibility, we have too much to do, to give it up to the next Wednesday to do it. And then we send it out to the members, because we'll not be here. So you will get it through your emails next Wednesday. Okay. Now for tomorrow's sitting, you already have from Antonio a sort of guide which we sent to actually the people appearing before. So it's been sent to your email while you were sitting here. So tomorrow is the last sitting for this quarter. Also, members might be aware this afternoon the minister will introduce rates and monitoring within the House, which he has to do because of the money bill. Is that right? It's happening now, it's postponed. To when? Yeah, but you see, we've got a program, we have to deliver. So the first sitting, because otherwise then our public hearings can't take place and so on, right? Or can they? Can we talk about that meeting? Because you told me it's going to be done today, which is why I juggle the program around. The thing is the program for the third quarter is Reserve Bank. We have to put them in there because
after Makosi is prodding, we agreed the committee, we need to call them here, right? So that's the one outstanding thing. Will you remind me, Cindy, because I'll be here. What's your job while Alice not here? Just remind me, I'll insert that in. Fine, that's that. And then on third, it is a debate, right? Is that right? It's about building inclusivity around economic growth or something. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow.
This morning, later I came to you, my sister, from Europe.